This podcast is marketing material for a South Africa investment professional only.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Global Markets Perspective podcast. My name is Kondi Nkosi. I'm the Schroder South Africa country head. A lot has happened over the last couple of weeks in the banking sector that has reminded us all that banks are businesses that critically depend on the confidence of depositors and investors. An erosion thereof can have dire consequences. Given this backdrop, we felt it appropriate to share with you a recording of a conversation that our colleague Eugenio Ciccone, head of Global Financial Client Group, had with Justin Bissica, pan-European banks analyst at Schroders, where they unpack what has happened in the Credit Suisse emergency takeover by UBS, initiated by the Swiss National Bank, the Swiss regulator, and that country's finance minister. We hope you find it insightful.
Good morning. My name is Eugenio Ciccone, and today I have with me Justin Bissica, pan-European banks analyst. Justin, thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Busy week.
Yes, again.
So, as you all know, we recently changed the format of this podcast, which is now three question with. So, the three question that I'm going to ask Justin today, you can guess, are on banks and are on the UBS CS deal that was recently announced on Sunday. So, the question for Justin are, can you explain what the additional tier one are? Why writing them off in the UBS Credit Suisse deal created this market reaction? And what is, just in your assessment as an expert, of the European banking sector? Is there a systemic risk? So let's start with the first question. These instruments, the additional tier one, what are they?
Okay, so if we go back to the global financial crisis, governments felt that they had no option but to basically step in and put capital into banks, where the banks were unable to raise the money from investors. You know, many tried and they had rights issues, but the rights issues often failed. We saw that obviously very, very dramatic with the case of RBS in the UK. The rights issues failed and the shares ended up going to the government and the taxpayer. So post global financial crisis, there was a lot of thinking around, well, how could you make sure that never again would a bank failure mean that taxpayers had to pay for it? And one of the things that was done was to come up with a new form of equity in the bank, which was an AT1. Originally, they were often called COCOs, contingent convertible securities. And the idea of these AT1s, or additional tier ones, is that they are bonds in normal times, but they become equity-like if certain specified things happen. So they normally have what are called triggers. So banks are regulated in many ways. One of the ways in which they're regulated is they have to hold a certain level of core tier one capital. So they have to meet a certain core tier one ratio. So most banks I cover have core tier one ratios in the range of about 12% to 15% or so. Credit Suisse actually had a core tier one ratio over 14%. And the way these AT1s work is if core tier one capital was ever to deplete to that trigger level, and those trigger levels vary, but they are low. They are very low. And this is one of the problems.
6.5%.
They are typically, 7%, something like that. Sometimes even lower.
Yeah.
The point is that by the time capital gets down to that level, the market's already lost confidence. I mean, here we are with Credit Suisse and the market had already lost confidence at a 14% plus core tier one ratio. The reason why these AT1s are very important is that they can trigger into equity, or they can be written off, and the absence of a liability, of course, creates equity if certain things happen. But the problem is you get these trigger points, but the other thing that could trigger this, the conversion of the AT1s, is regulatory intervention. If the regulator says, we don't think you're viable anymore, that's it. These AT1s convert. Now, that makes them pretty risky instruments for investors to own, because you just need a snap decision by a regulator over a weekend to say, I don't think this business is viable anymore, and you lose all your money. So they are very important in protecting taxpayers from the failure of banks. But I think some people did not understand the risk inherent in these instruments. And I've puzzled for a number of years, actually, as to why it could possibly be the case that bank equity, so the stuff I look at, often had a dividend yield that was actually higher than the AT1 coupon cost. To me, that made no sense at all. And now we know why. It was because people had driven, I think, these AT1 yields to too low a level.
Yeah, and on your
point,
they
hadn't understood the risk.
In theory, they are senior to equity, but when they are triggered for one way or another, they never behave in this
way.
No,
they become
like this.
Equity. And the other thing is there are nuances around the AT1s. So the good thing about 81 is it's like, think of it as being a prearranged rights issue. Okay. You get into trouble, you can't have a rights issue. Credit Suisse couldn't have a rights issue over the weekend. How could they magic up 16 billion of capital? Obviously by triggering these 81s.
We have addressed already the second question, but I think I would specify a bit one moment yesterday in the market that clarify exactly what you mentioned now. The ECB at some point step in and said, guys, for us, 81 are senior to equity.
Yeah, so the ECB and the Bank of England both put out statements saying that they would respect the creditor hierarchy, that basically you should have a hierarchy of creditors, and within that hierarchy, the 81s should be senior to equity. So the equity holders should lose all their money first.
So if I read correctly what we have discussed so far, we don't see a systemic risk here.
No, I don't think so. So I think if we think about all the events that have happened over the past week and a half, so in the US, we've seen the failure of three banks, Silvergate, which was really a crypto bank, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank. We have seen in the US a flight to quality amongst depositors and a flight from smaller institutions to larger institutions. That is an ongoing issue in the US, I think, and that is something that Fed is going to have to think about very carefully when they're setting monetary policy. When we think about the UK and Europe, I don't think that there is going to be any sort of involuntary monetary tightening that happens because the banking system starts restraining credit from not providing credit to customers when they want it. In the global financial crisis, banks didn't want to lend money. They couldn't lend money because they were running out of cash. Central banks were not fast enough to provide liquidity to them. Banks didn't have appropriate liquidity buffers. Banks didn't have enough capital, and they had balance sheets which had a lot of AAA instruments in them, subprime CDOs, which they thought were money good and they were money bad. This is very, very different. So I think, yes, in the US, there will be some monetary tightening effectively imposed by the banking system, which will make the Fed more dovish in time. In the UK and Europe, I don't think that this is going to have a particularly meaningful impact on the willingness of any bank to provide credit, on the assumption that we don't see a very significant macro downturn. And I would remind you that, you know, what we have seen in Q4 and what we will see again in Q1 are very benign risk indicators, very benign. There's minimal need for banks to book new credit losses. Banks in the UK and Europe have very large stage two provisioning buffers. So these are provisions which cover fully performing loans. They've seen a significant increase in credit risk, but that might be from like a 5 basis point probability of default to a 15 basis point probability of default. It's still very, very low. But there are very big provisioning buffers in place that mean that most banks can see actually provisioning needs go up quite a bit before they actually even need to book new provisioning costs in the P&L. So I don't think there's a risk issue from the reactions of the banks having an impact on the real economy in the UK or Europe. Is there an issue from, you know, depositor flight? You know, one of the scary things we've seen here is that we have seen very material volumes of deposit exit banks very, very quickly. This is what we saw at Silicon Valley Bank. It's what we, you know, it's what we've seen at Signature Bank in the States. It's what we've seen at Credit Suisse. So I think what will happen is that liquidity regulation will need to be tightened. It will need to be more granular. So at the moment, there is something called a liquidity coverage ratio. It has modelled outflows over a 30-day period. But those modelled outflows are actually, I don't think, draconian enough for some types of deposits. So you have to differentiate more between deposit types, I think, within banks. And deposits which are lumpy and uninsured, I think banks will need to hold higher liquidity buffers behind them. But again, does that create some sort of systemic issue in the sector? No, not at all. You know, this is something the banks can manage. It will be new regulation that's phased in over time. How would you manage such a regulatory requirement? Well, you'd hold more high-quality liquid assets in your balance sheet. You may be able to lend a little bit less because you've got to own more HQLAs, but the reality is that's not going to be having a massive impact on bank earnings or on the real economy. So now I don't think this is a systemic issue. This is not like some house of cards that we saw in the global financial crisis, where it turned out that pretty much every bank balance sheet had quite a large volume of subprime CDOs sitting within it, and nobody knew how large that market was. And everybody had assumed, particularly the credit rating agencies, that these were money good assets and they weren't worth anything. And the whole system dried up.
Yeah.
We're not in that situation at all.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you, Justin, for sharing your expertise and knowledge on the financial sector.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Eugenio.
That was Eugenio Ciccunetti and Justin Bisseker discussing the developments in the banking sector and the implications on the broader system. Thank you for joining us this week for the Global Markets Perspective podcast. We're looking forward to bringing you more great content next month. Goodbye.
The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance and may not be repeated. Schroders Investment Management Limited is an authorized financial services provider. FSP number 48998. Registration number 01893220, incorporated in England and Wales. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation. Any funds, services, or products mentioned might not be appropriate for all listeners. Please speak to a financial advisor if you are unsure as to the suitability of any investment.
The forecasts included are not guaranteed. They are provided only as at the date of issue and should not be relied upon. Our forecasts are based on our own assumptions, which may change. We accept no responsibility for any errors of fact or opinion and assume no obligation to provide you with any changes to our assumptions or forecasts. Forecasts and assumptions may be affected by external, economic, or other factors.